Good morning, everybody. This is April the 8th. This is the Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, and we are into universities today. We've been doing community colleges for a while, and now we're switching over to the universities. We'll be dealing with the 7 Oregon public universities, and then later on we'll be doing OHSU as well. And Paul is with us today. And Paul, anything for the good of the order?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I would just note that at your places there's a couple of responses from questions from yesterday, and those will be posted later today into OLIS under yesterday's date.
Okay. Ben? Oh. Opening the public hearing on 5024.
Good morning, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ben Cannon, Executive Director of Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Great to be back and introduce to you today the director of our budget and finance unit that works most closely with the public universities, Brian Fox. He'll take over in a few minutes. Really, our role today is to help frame the presentations that you'll hear over the next couple of days from the public universities, and they'll be describing some of their efforts to improve student success. But we wanted to sort of frame those comments by giving you some background both on the budget request as well as the enrollment and completion and demographic trends that our universities are experiencing. So with that, I'm going to jump right into the show. I'll pause on the picture, Representative Cope. There's some good ones.
Good.
The budget, as you know, reflects a requested increase in the primary way in which the state funds public universities, which is the Public University Support Fund. You'll note here that there's a slight diminishment in the CSL budget for some technical reasons, and then a request through a couple of POPs for additional funding within the Public University Support Fund. Importantly, a good chunk of that additional funding request is really just the continuation of the tuition buy-down from the last biennium. You'll also note here the public university debt service, the sort of obligations of the state, and their increase. We'll have some additional context on this in upcoming slides. These two, we'll be focusing today and for a portion of tomorrow, really on the Public University Support Fund. There are other state general funds associated with support for public universities, and we'll be turning to those starting tomorrow through the state's investment in state programs, in the statewides, and other modest sources of support for our public universities. But the primary, the core funding source is the Public University Support Fund, and that's where we'll focus our attention today. Just to sort of note and remind you of the HEX investment priorities. So as the commission took the broadest possible view of the higher education landscape, everything that you're hearing about from workforce development to community colleges to our public and private universities, it sort of distilled its mission around these major headings. In terms of the first and public universities, you'll hear in a few minutes about our ongoing efforts to help shape the way the state's investment really focuses on student outcomes. We're in the process of the commission's in the process of developing and implementing a new allocation method for allocating the state's dollars, a new formula for allocating the state's dollars that really aligns our investments with the state goal of 40-40-20. Affordability, the tuition buy-down, the continuation of this, the reinvestment in the institutions, and the capital requests that we are bringing forward help to address some of the commission's priorities around affordability. And finally, you see here the commission's emphasis on student success outcomes. Again, the formula work that we're doing, the importance that the commission has, the emphasis the commission's placed on quality, and some of the related work that we're doing to help measure and evaluate our public universities for their quality results for students, or quality impacts on students, sort of falls under this heading of student success outcomes. You've seen this data before. I'm not going to walk through it in any detail, but it's, I think it's important. It's sort of our core barometer for the success of our higher education system against the 40-40-20 goals. We have a long ways to go. You know that. I will again highlight the fact that we have a bunch of students who are enrolled or have enrolled in higher education but not completed, and you'll see that most specifically with the public universities here in a couple of minutes. This is a sort of slightly different view that looks just at bachelor's degree attainment and looks at the sort of pipeline of recent high school graduates, shows the sort of, as you proceed in years beyond the high school graduation date here on the x-axis, so as time passes, more and more students from that class, that high school graduating class, earn a BA, but we're still far short of that blue line, which is the goal, the dashed line, which is the 40%. So our state's responsibility, our commission's responsibility is to try to shift this graph up and to the left, or shift these bars, if you will, up and to the left. And that would reflect quicker time to degree, and it would reflect more students earning degrees. Again, data that you've seen before. This is projections of Oregon's graduates, high school graduates, by race and ethnicity over time.
Representative Springer has a question.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Can you back up to that last slide, Ben? Thank you. We really have that large of a proportion of students taking 7 years?
So, Representative Springer, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, the number of students who are actually completing in 7 years is the difference between the six and the seven. So what this is attempting to show, not perhaps as elegantly as it could, is the fact that as more time passes, more students earn degrees naturally. There's a sort of leveling off, as you would expect. The steepest slopes here are 4 to 5, 5 to 6, and then it starts to level. So it does, I think your point is important, that there are actually, I mean, there's still pretty significant growth between 6 and 7, reflecting students who are taking or are completing 7 years after graduation. That said, some of those students probably did not begin. They took a gap, right? They may not have begun directly out of high school. We have data that suggests those students are less likely to complete if they take that gap. But nevertheless, that's a portion of those students.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair. And I realize the gap could be a factor, and maybe coming in and going out could be a factor, or just kind of plugging along at a slower pace. Do we have the data that correlates to the student debt at that stage or incrementally at any point? Because my guess would be the student debt, they may be taking a gap, but I bet my hope would be they'd be working and paying, but my guess is the student debt might be higher.
Representative Springer, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, yes, we do have data specific to Oregon Public Universities, and it's we showed a version of it back when we were talking about affordability. So on day three, I believe, and I don't have the date for you to look at on OLIS, but we can highlight it again. It was slide 11 that describes how students who graduate in 6 years have significantly more debt than students who graduate in four. And that is certainly one of the concerns and priorities of the commission.
Thank you.
Just again on the demographics, we showed a version of this slide. I am, to be honest, I'm a little bit frustrated with this slide. This slide is an attempt to depict the increasing diversity of Oregon's high school graduates, and it does so. You see the growing wedge of students that over time will be in the Hispanic category. Unfortunately, what this slide also does is the projections beyond 2014-15 assume a sort of status quo graduation rate for every one of these. And actually, Representative Springer had questions. We had some follow-up about this slide after the first time we showed it related to that American Indian bar on the top, or line on the top. This slide essentially assumes status quo, and as a result, it assumes significantly lower graduation rate for some of our students of color than of our than others, and it, to my mind, as a result, actually does a couple of things. One, it underemphasizes the degree to which Oregon's demographics are changing. It actually underrepresents that, and it may suggest that higher education doesn't have some obligation for changing our high school graduation rates. And in fact, our public universities, our community colleges, are working with high schools, with K-12 systems to improve these numbers for all students. And so what I would hope is that the projections here actually under account for both total graduates as well as the high school graduates who are students of color. So just a caveat around that. But it does emphasize the fact that Oregon's population is increasingly diverse, and that creates both great opportunities for our colleges and universities and also challenges. We're going to look at enrollment a little more, or start to look at enrollment over the next few slides, and then importantly turn to completion, which is clearly our focus. So this chart depicts for our public universities, our seven public universities, the enrollment broken down by part-time students, resident students, and non-resident students. A couple of things to note here. One is the overall increases in enrollment and the increases in every each of the two major categories, the full-time categories of non-resident and resident. Pretty significant increases, and I think you know this, pretty significant increases in sort of percentage terms in non-resident enrollment. That, frankly, is part of the way that our universities have financed their ability in the face of state funding cuts, have paid for maintaining or even increasing enrollment of resident students. So the fact that the green bars on the bottom here have increased or at least stayed flat, even in an era over the last 6 years of significant state funding cuts, reflects the growth in part reflects the growth of non-resident students who, of course, are paying significantly more tuition and are helping to subsidize, if you will, the resident students in the green bars at the bottom. I will note those green bars flatten over the last few years and even a slight downturn, which should be at least a point of attention, if not concern. We'll look at the completion data in a couple of minutes. Probably not surprising, though, and we've seen the tail off the downturn in community college enrollment, here the flattening in public university enrollment, really a reflection more than anything of an improving economy that creates more job opportunities for students and alternatives to higher education.
Are we going to see those numbers for individual universities? Because I've been told that, like, U of O has a much higher percentage of non-resident students than any other university in the state.
Senator Monroe, Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Kump, we would be happy to provide that data. It's not in our slide deck, but we'd be happy to follow up with you with that data. And it is correct that ratio varies a lot.
I think there's a dramatic difference between, like, Portland State and U of O in terms of the percentage of non-resident.
Senator Monroe.
I don't know what that means, but I believe that's the case.
We'd be happy to follow up. All or at least most, perhaps all save one of our public universities have certainly emphasized and looked to increase their non-resident enrollment in order to help finance the resident student population. Looking again, similar data around increasing diversity. This is enrollment history at our public universities by non-resident foreign students. That's the non-resident alien bar at the bottom, white, minority, and unknown. There were some definitional changes, federal changes in 2009 that sort of make it a little bit harder to compare the data before and after that time. Nevertheless, you can see here the university system significantly increasing the diversity of the student population. I will note that this graph includes non-resident students, so non-Oregon students who are also U.S. resident students and aren't broken out separately here. So I think we have some work to do to focus this on Oregon resident students. Nevertheless, a significant increase in the diversity of Oregon's public university students. And likewise, and I think equally importantly, significant increase in the number of Oregon public university students who are low income, who are Pell eligible. And actually, I find this slide very heartening to see that Oregon public universities over time, and certainly since the mid-2000s, are serving not only many more students, but many more Pell students. Now, I say heartening. There's an aspect of this which is probably disheartening, which is that Oregon's population is increasingly needy and has increasing percentages of Oregon's population are undoubtedly Pell eligible. That said, it is a positive that our public universities are better reflecting the income ranges in Oregon's population and the need of Oregon's population.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Is any part of this increase in the Pell recipients attributable to more awards, or is it more eligible recipients applying, which would infer to me there is money left on the table prior?
Representative Springer, Mr. Co-Chair, there was a change in the definition, the eligibility definition, in 2008, and that does account for some of the increase, likely accounts for some of the increase here, as does the increasing need of Oregon's student population. We look at the growth in the free and reduced lunch eligible students population from K-12, significant increases since the early 2000s. And that's carries forward into our Pell population. But there was also a definitional change here.
Thank you.
I know there was interest early on in sort of how, to what extent our higher education system serves students in ways that are geographically diverse, east, west, urban, rural, however you want to look at it. Here it's depicted by county. And please note, this is not a sort of holistic view of higher education participation by county. It is a fairly narrow view of the percentage of the county's high school graduates who enrolled the following year in an Oregon public university. So take it for what it's worth. It does show significant discrepancies and actually very significant differences from county to county. One thing we take away from this is that proximity matters. There appears to be a greater likelihood that a high school graduate will attend a public university when they live near a public university. That should not be surprising, but it helps underscore the importance of our regional universities for access to higher education. We've talked about that a little in this committee already.
Kathleen.
Yes, thank you, Chair Monroe. So do you look at things like, look at Gilliam County, 46%, Wasco, 7%, obviously those would be two glaring examples, but do you look and see, in Gilliam County, is there some sort of consistency with those districts of they having all the kids take the SAT? Are they, is their graduation rate higher, or what's, why is Wasco, what's happening there? I mean, is there some sort of additional analysis that goes on, or do you have to rely on the high schools for that?
Representative Taylor, Co-Chair Monroe, we've not done that analysis for this particular slide. I think it's a intriguing one. It does raise those questions, and I would be very interested in partnering with ODE and our K-12 colleagues to understand better why these discrepancies. Obviously, for some of these counties, your population, your sort of size here is very small,
right?
A small number of high school graduates per year, which can probably result in some pretty significant discrepancies. Nevertheless, I mean, the difference between Gilliam and Wheeler, adjacent counties, does at least raise questions. I sort of look to Representative Huffman because we, you know, looking through this data was going, interesting, and there's probably some fairly straightforward answer. But
I got three really low ones up there that's not encouraging.
Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm shocked at Marion County being 13%. I mean, that just blows me away. But some of these places, I think Lake County is one of them. I'm not sure what the Clemens dollars in Benton County are doing right now, but some of these schools have even full scholarships for some of their graduating seniors. So I would certainly anticipate that impacting that number a great deal.
Senator Thompson.
So those are Oregon public schools. Do you have any info? Are they going out of state? Did you look at that?
Senator Thompson, Co-Chair Monroe, we have not looked at this data. We do not have this data by county for high school graduates who may be attending out-of-state schools, maybe attend, and frankly, this doesn't take into account even community college enrollment.
Oh.
So, again, it's a fairly narrow picture. It's really just focused on the seven public universities.
Well, and it doesn't take into consideration the private universities. In some of these counties, there are some significant populations in the private universities, like Marion County, for example. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The more I look at the slide, the more confused I get, Ben. So the label on the slide is rural freshman participation. Mm-hmm. I was assuming we're talking all counties. So how do those two things go together? And then down here, this box says rural-urban participation rates. Rural counties are 16%. Urban counties are 20%. Could you break some of that out for me a little bit? And just maybe why it's all the rural freshmen.
Representative Springer, Co-Chair Monroe, it's a mislabeled slide.
Okay.
It should not be headed rural freshman participation. It does reflect statewide. And then the I could not tell you precisely which counties have been included under the rural definition and the urban definition. Obviously, at a county level, that's very crude. But that's essentially there's been an attempt to depict the rate by that breakdown, rural versus urban. And that's what's in the box on the right-hand side.
For the record, Brian Fox, Director of Public University Budget and Finance, we have sort of done follow-on analysis for this to some degree, breaking it down to individual high schools, which are classified by their urban-rural status by the Census Department. And so we have sort of deeper and more nuanced information on a high-school-by-high-school basis of enrollment patterns from the sort of students leaving the K through 12 system and moving into the university system. So we do have sort of more nuanced data that you don't see here, though we did sort of hope to demonstrate to some degree or another that there is drastic differences by geographic distribution in the enrollment in public universities.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Could you send me that data on Linn County, Marion County, Grant County, and Union County?
Final slide on enrollment before we talk about completion for a few minutes. This reflects a conversation that we've had with you before we started talking about community colleges and their very important role in feeding the advanced 40. And you see here the significant increases. I mean, these are 50, 60, 70% increases in just in the less than the last decade in the number of transfer students from Oregon community colleges to public universities. And this is a important phenomenon, a one that students who take advantage of benefit from. The success of these community college transfer students is quite good. They have earned a sort of lower cost. They've typically had a lower cost to them experience in community colleges in the first 2 years. It creates challenges. It puts pressures on our university budgets that the lower division courses tend to be the lower division experience tends to be less expensive for a university to offer. So it's a, as we begin to talk about the sort of cost structures and state funding, it's a worth keeping in mind that there are some challenges to, for public universities associated with this trend. For students, however, it appears to be a quite a positive one.
Well, in 08, 09, that when the recession was at its worst, community college enrollments really spiked dramatically in the 08 to 10.
Yeah.
And then you can see that those kids, you know, stayed there a couple of years and then transferred to a university. And that's why the big climb there. It makes sense.
So now looking at completion, so we've been, the last slides have been solely focused really on enrollment in public universities. Now the real 40-40-20 test, which is completion, this slide breaks out completions, and this means completions of degrees, undergraduate and graduate, for our non-resident students, our resident students, and total students. And you see here, again, significantly positive trends in every category over time. Some flattening of resident student degree completion over the last couple of years as enrollment has flattened and as the sort of demographic and economic trends that Senator Monroe just alluded to came into play. The part of the major challenge for the state and for our institutions will be to improve, keep that resident completion trend line moving up, even in the face of enrollment that's likely to be flat or only modestly up. How do you really steepen that slope, getting more students to completion, even as our universities don't double in size, right? There likely will need to be some enrollment growth of resident students, but our real focus here is on figuring out how to improve the completion numbers. When we break down, when we look at a sort of graduation rate, in had some discussion very early in our presentations to you of this data, but when we look at our graduation rates by across the board, that's the red line. These are expressed as six-year graduation rates. I know we provided to you previously the a 4- and 5-year look. At about 60%, some significant differences by race, ethnicity, and some modest trends over time, although they vary by group. If there was one piece of data that I believe you and our commission ought to pay attention to with respect to public universities, it's this. And it is the number of Pell students that's expressed in the green wedge here who earn degrees. This, to me, is really the key. I think a lot, I don't want to sound sort of cavalier here, but I think a lot of the rest will take care of itself. The profound question and challenge for Oregon policymakers and institutional leaders is how to ensure that that public universities remain a ladder of opportunity for low-income students. And what this slide depicts is that ladder exists. We have thousands of Oregon students who are low-income, eligible for Pell, earning degrees, and that trend has been positive. And our challenge, and given all of the trends and challenges, especially financial, that you've seen, I think it's quite a profound one, is to ensure that these numbers continue to increase.
That's a pretty dramatic number. A decade ago, only a third basically were Pell recipients, third of graduates. Today it's almost half.
And Mr. Co-Chair, again, yes, with the little caveat that there was a definitional change in 2008 that resulted in many more students being eligible for Pell. So that is impacting this to some extent.
Yeah, Betty and I pushed that through. Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Monroe. Ben, I really like your slides. They're so good. They're so informative. I appreciate it. They're really good. I did have a question about, do you have a slide or some information about the graduation rates for, or the lack of graduation rates, I should say, for Pell recipients? So I was just wondering what, in proportion of the students that receive Pells, you know, how many graduate versus not graduate?
Representative Taylor, co-chairs,
and
yes.
It's also Barbara Smith-Warner's question
slide,
also.
We will provide it. We do have the data. We'll focus on resident Pell students and provide their graduation rate compared with the overall or the non-Pell population.
And then follow up. If you're going to be going to that effort, because I'm pretty sure you already have this information, so I don't think I'll be asking too much, but can you show for the students who don't receive any financial aid, because isn't it approximately half of the students in the seven universities don't receive any financial aid, something like that? Something, I don't know. The graduation rates for those who don't receive any financial aid versus receive some financial aid but not necessarily Pell, and then the same for the Pells would be interesting if that's possible. Does that make sense?
Representative Taylor, Co-Chair Monroe, we'll follow. The financial aid question will be a more difficult one because of the various forms of financial aid, from tuition discounting, other institutional sort of scholarships, federal Pell, state opportunity grant. But we have, I think there's some portion of your request that we can be quickly responsive to.
All right, thank you.
My staff is getting very anxious.
Don't make it too hard.
Final for me, and then we'll look at state investment. And then we do want to make sure that you have ample time to hear from some of the folks who have traveled a great distance today to speak with you about their work at public universities. But really, here this slide it really just underscores much of what I've already said around enrollment and completion trends. I guess I just want to emphasize that the easiest approach to 40-40-20 would be for our universities to really focus on the students who are likeliest to succeed, you know, reduce access. And what you see reflected here is, I think, an ongoing commitment on their part to focus on students of all types to reach down and out for those students to help pull them through. That is also the HECS commitment, that it's going to require a real attention to this data and to work around access, pathways, incentives, and rewards for serving those students who mirror Oregon's diversity. So I'll leave it at that for now. We'll turn over to look at a few slides on the state investment, and you'll see some of the financial trends that that bear on public universities. Brian.
Thank you, Ben. Again, for the record, Brian Fox, Director of Public University Budget and Finance for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the subcommittee, you know, I'd like to actually start this out with a high note. In 2007, 2009, there was a large investment in higher education in the state of Oregon. Since then, we have gone through a very significant recession, have begun to make reinvestments in higher education in the last biennium, and the governor's recommended budget has recommended another significant investment in higher education. Certainly not as much as will get us all of our hopes and dreams, but a significant down payment towards 40-40-20, specifically a $75.7 million increase, a significant portion of which goes to continue the tuition offsets, which were put forward in the last biennium. Those dollars, unfortunately, those represent additional state resources. To a large degree, those don't represent additional resources for an institution, in that they really offset those dollars that otherwise would have come in through tuition increases. That money matters. It doesn't, in often cases, buy new services for the institution, which makes it sort of tricky or difficult to use. You will notice, looking over time, that the governor's recommended budget for 15-17 gets us up and surpasses, actually, the investment in 2007-2009. However, in all operating funds, it's less than it was in 2007-2009. And that's due in large part to a significant increase in debt service payments. As the state, through the recession, in many ways had to truncate their investment in operating support, the state stepped up in capital support, building buildings, building capacity, both for research, for student services, and in core classroom space. Those bills come due. That's an important way that the state invests in our higher education institutions, but it has a long-term cost. Moving to the next slide, this really takes and combines two pieces of information. One, the last slide on overall state investment, and then the earlier slide on resident enrollment, and looks in a per student basis what the state is investing. And you'll notice quickly that in non-inflation adjusted dollars between the 1999-01 session, or 1999-01 biennium, and 2013-15, there was a $984 decrease on a per student basis, $1,000 less, non-inflation adjusted, what the state is investing in higher education. It's over 15 years. If you move to the next slide, the institutions, sort of by nature, have had to look to other revenue sources to finance their expansion. And again, over that time, the seven public universities have grown by leaps and bounds, significantly in resident students, and at the same time had to find additional resources and have done so through tuition. It's worth noting, and not included in that slide, is that much of the increase in tuition has been offset by increase in fee remissions, or really tuition remissions back to students, much of that targeted at low-income students, much of that targeted at resident students. So the institutions, and some of which have more capacity than others to do this, have increased tuition and then plowed much of those resources back in to the students that are most needy. And so tuition increases, though never great, as the state has backed out, have been required at times to finance the institutions. At the same time, institutions have used those resources to ameliorate some of the burden.
What is the comparable average community college tuition comparable to that 8,200 at our universities?
I don't have that information on the top of my head, but we can follow up.
Okay.
And the next slide really underscores the point that from the early 2000s to today, the state's share of the operating investment in core education in general, resources for the institutions, has really fallen from, you know, roughly a half in the early 2000s to less than 20% today. At the same time, tuition and fees has increased to the broad majority of the education and general expenses, or the financing of education and general expenses. That includes non-resident tuition, which is a significant portion of these funds. You know, it's worth noting that as the state stands to make a major reinvestment in higher education during this biennium, even significant increases on a relatively small portion of the education and general base leads to, on a percentage basis, a relatively small increase in the overall budgets for institutions. So I know that there are questions. You know, if the state is looking to invest 10% more, why would you see tuition increases? The state's investing so much more. The state is investing more, and those new dollars mean new services. That means new investment in the institutions. But when 80% of your funds come from tuition, and 100% of your costs experience inflation, experience pressures, cost pressures on them, you have to make up for those costs in other ways, even if there's significant increases in state resources. That's not to downplay that.
I'm co-chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The 8% that's other, can you give us a definition of what other means?
I can follow up with that information.
You're telling me you don't have that information right now.
I don't have it off the top of my head.
Mr. Chair, I represent COP. Bill McGee, Department of Administrative Services. The largest piece of that is indirect cost recovery on grants that's retained for the operation institutions. There are some other kind of non-academic fees that go into that as well, but the cost recovery, grant cost recovery, is the biggest piece of it.
Thank you, Mr. McGee.
Go ahead.
Because I'm wondering if you're going to give us a slide presentation of what foundations and other entities do to create a little more balance there, because many of us know that U of O has great foundation, OHSU has an incredible foundation, but I'm sitting here looking at my friend from OSU, and I don't have any idea how much they had to offset or help their budget. Thank you.
Absolutely. And then moving to the next slide, this slide represents the educational appropriations on a per FTE basis for all 50 states in the nation, and this includes both universities and community colleges. And again, I know that this information has been brought up many times before, but the state of Oregon on a per FTE basis is way below its peers, is really 47th in the nation. If we move to the next slide, this is really the nexus, I think, of the information that has come before. It's the financial information and it's the completion information. And with this slide, I know it's a little confusing if we go to the next one. With this on the horizontal axis, this is the total resources available to an institution per graduate. And then on the vertical axis, it's the number of credentials granted per 100 students. And what you see is that Oregon's research universities, and we'll see a similar slide for the technical and regional institutions, have relatively low cost, but have almost middle productivity. Mm-hmm. That's an incredible statement that our institutions are able, with relatively low amount of resources, to produce the same amount of graduates as their peers across the nation. And so I think this is a great statement to the productivity of our institutions as it stands today. And again, this is for the technical and regional institutions.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm curious about the different sources that you're using for these slides. The one that was back here three slides ago has information, the sources, state higher education executive offices. This current slide is from NCHAMS, mm-hmm. and sometimes we get statistical information from WICHE. Mm-hmm. Is there a reason why we're not just using one source as our foundation for information, or help me out? Because it makes me a little suspicious.
Absolutely. Co-Chair Monroe, Co-Chair Comp, members of the subcommittee. You know, there's a universe of organizations out there in the higher education sphere, including, you know, oftentimes we look towards SHEO, the State Higher Education Executive Organization, WICHE, and then NCHEMS, each of which focus on higher education metrics, on financing. They collect different information. They often sort of work together to provide different or to utilize different information sources. Much of my and my staff's time is actually spent answering requests from these institutions to provide data. And so really we have to know one information source provides everything. And so we work with many, and really there are a few in the higher education sphere that collect authoritative data, are very sort of neat in particular to ensure that they get good data so that policymakers, the legislators, and that institutions can work with that information and understand what those investments are.
Thank you.
Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could I just ask, there was a slide that showed up on your presentation that has all the states, and that is not on the one that's on OLIS for some reason. So could you throw that in as a... It's probably a graphics thing, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. If you could make sure to send that as an additional.
We will.
Thank
we will
you.
Do so. I want to just conclude with this, and then we'll...
Yeah.
Okay, so, there we go. This slide just really summarizes what you've heard about the funding and productivity of the institutions. The big takeaway at the bottom that Brian alluded to, that our universities are remarkably efficient at successfully serving students with relatively little total resources. That's based on the national data that you've mm-hmm. just seen. Finally, and before we turn it over to colleagues, wanted to touch on the work that the commission has underway to focus the state resources on serving students and improving student success. We're doing so through modifications to the state's the HECS distribution formula of state resources to institutions, shifting the basis from that from enrollment, which is essentially the very largest and almost only portion of the way the state distributes dollars today to enrollment and completion, which is what will be the case starting next year, assuming that that formula change is adopted. There are weights to emphasize completion for underrepresented students, including low-income, rural, veteran, and underrepresented minority students. And there are weights to account for the fact that the cost structures differ from institution to institution, or I should say the cost structures differ from program and degree type, from as well as by institution to institution. We account for the greater, the lesser economies of scale at regional institutions and put additional resources into a base for them. That work is summarized on the final slide here before the KPMs. We would be happy to follow up, as we've expressed before, with the subcommittee with a much more in detail, in-depth presentation of the work on the funding formula, if your time and permits and your interest is there. With that, I'll note that we are proposing a number of KPMs that carry forward existing key performance measures, eliminate some, and propose perhaps one or two new ones. I actually think the most significant difference in how we're proposing to address KPMs is to focus really on resident students. The prior sort of generation of KPMs more often sort of blended the total student population. So we'll be bringing these forward to you with all the numbers shortly. With that, I encourage the committee to invite representatives of our public universities, starting with Xavier Romano from Eastern Oregon University, their VP for Student Services, to describe some of the work that's underway on our campuses to reach these lofty outcomes that we've set a goal towards.
Okay. Representative Smith Warner.
Thank you. If I just briefly thank you, that's all really good information. And I just want to, it really strikes me that the move in this, and I think we will end up talking about these KPMs, but the straight to 6-year graduation rate and not even pausing at 5, because I think, as we've talked a lot about, I mean, that is a significant cost increase and everything else. And I would just like to say for the record that, you know, I have some concern about using that as a metric.
Thank you.
Okay. We're ready for Mr. Romano.
Good morning, and good morning, Co-Chairs Monroe and Comp. I apologize for my sinuses. I have my toolkit here. The air actually is different on the west side than in La Grande, and I can testify to this. I'm going to do something that's going to make some of my colleagues a little anxious and a little bit nervous. Because of the time, I'm going to speak in some broad themes and get some points across, but similarly.
Representative Smith Warner.
I just wondered if he could identify himself.
Oh, forgive me. My name is Javier Romano, and I'm the Vice President for Student Services at Eastern Oregon University. I have just finished my first year back in Oregon after 20 years of being away, working in higher education in California, Pennsylvania, Illinois, Saudi Arabia, and ironically, was the first director of minority student affairs at Western Oregon State College, to give you a sense of perspective, under Dick Myers. So it is a joy to be back here and to be back in the state after such a long period of time. We're all here for the same reason, and it's important that we make the time to allow the students to tell their stories. Today, we're here to talk about finances. The reason that we need student support is, in essence, to ensure that the environment of higher education that matters most to students, particularly those students on the fringes, are what we call touch point services or student services. We're all here for the same reason, to make sure the students are successful so that we can support them through their education and get them a degree. They have fulfilling careers and make a contribution to Oregon and to society as a whole. Why do we care? Well, for all the right reasons. But I would submit to you, we also care because it's about our collective future interests. It's about all of us. It's about our future. We know some basic pieces. We know that graduate incomes support Oregon priorities across the board from K-12 to K education and healthcare and public safety. I believe that Ben Cannon and the HEC staff provided some of these statistics to you in earlier testimony. The more education that somebody has, the less revenue spent on public services for them. As education and incomes increase, use of social safety nets decrease, as do our incarceration rates. More jobs and a stronger, more stable, diverse workforce is an outcome. Companies are expanding in Oregon and coming to Oregon so long as we provide those students that allow them to flourish. We can never become the great state we wish to be from an economic standpoint if our graduates have to leave the state and secure employment elsewhere. Strong communities are present, and there's a strong middle class. Higher education attainment rates are the key to rebuilding a middle class in the state, the key to reinvigorating Oregon towns, cities, communities from east to west, north to south. You know this. This graduation of graduates is more entrepreneurial than ever before. We're seeing the graduates stay or return to their small cities and towns after graduation and starting companies that help rebuild not just urban Oregon, but rural Oregon. They invigorate, thank you, our towns, our communities, and in so doing, give back. So where are we now? Ensuring that all students are successful to degree. Well, I'm sorry to say that we're not in as good a place as we would like to be. What's happened? If we look at graduation rates over time, we'll see a pretty flat story. Upticks are most often related to infusions from a better than average budget year, infusions of more student services staff, infusions of grant aid for support programs, or infusions of money for scholarships and wraparound services. You can see the bump after the good budgets that OUS received in 2007. We are all working very hard to achieve our goal of more graduates. So why can't we make the needle move north? What's going on? About 50 years ago, in the mid-60s, we made the decision as a society to ensure that students had an opportunity to go to college, regardless of income. This was part of the Great Society program, which also spurred creation of the package of financial aid programs we know today as Pell and other federal aid programs, the creation of federal TRIO programs, which you'll hear more about, and other pre-college and support service programs. So financial aid and support programs were implemented that changed the entire makeup of our campuses, and they increased graduates by the thousands. In fact, I'm one of them. But over time, because of state and financial cuts in general fund and Pell Grant programs, we're returning to the world of the have and have-nots in the landscape of Oregon, and I would argue nationally. I don't believe that anybody wants this. I believe that we share a hope that there's an opportunity for all of us in Oregon. I was one of these students who ventured to Eugene, Oregon from San Diego, California because of such programs and because an opportunity was made available at the University of Oregon for me. Without that opportunity, I don't know where I would be today. I certainly don't think I would be in higher education. I know you've seen this chart before. Let's see here. But we remain 47th in funding per state per student in the nation. This number has moved slightly up and down between 44 and 47th. And a personal commentary, I've had the great fortune in my career to work in student services across the country and to serve on a number of national boards. Returning to Oregon this last year, I cannot begin to tell you the number of questions that I received from colleagues about state funding and appropriations and why, for such an enlightened state as Oregon is perceived to be, why we hold the position that we do nationally in higher education. And it's not an answer that I can provide, and I'm hard-pressed. And yet the word is out that this is a progressive state, that it is a land of intellectuals and opportunity, but there's this disconnect between our funding mechanisms and our public higher education. So this does not surprise you, I suspect. And it's a growing concern for all of us and all of our communities. So what are we doing? Well, while our number of degrees have increased dramatically over the last decade, as you saw, this is more to do because of enrollment increases, not because we've gotten much better at improving our retention or graduation rates. So why not cut the academics? Because then our students can't get the classes they need when they need them, and it takes longer to graduate. It adds more to costs and probably borrowing, and has a whole other set of negative side effects. It is a Sophie's choice of sorts, and we don't want to be able to be in that position to make. It's not a good situation for us, for our students who want to secure access and opportunity. This is difficult to say, but I will say it. The equity lens is cracked, and the safety net has a hole in it. The students who most need these supports, those who are the sidelines of the equity lens, are harmed the most. They are frequently the poor, the less academically prepared for the rigor of college, have no family experience with college attendance, often have more family responsibilities, have less access to transportation, and must work more, have fewer advocates. I see this on a daily basis in LeGrand in post-secondary education, both at Eastern Oregon and also at the community colleges. Why can't we catch these students? To put it bluntly, we don't have the warm bodies to do so. It's all about people helping people. This cannot be fabricated. We can't do it online. Students drop out when either we can't identify those students fast enough or can't get them routed to services fast enough because we lose them. Often it's one incident which moves a student to dropout, an unexpected bill they can't pay, an inability to secure childcare, failing an exam that puts them over the edge, or it can be something as straightforward as a divorce, which I recently had to deal with recently. What are the implications for 40-40-20? It's not an attainable goal with our current budget amounts. I'm sorry to be so blunt, but getting to 40-40-20 has such low confidence rating by practitioners in the academy that it's gone from the North Star to a black hole. We're not able to help these students to become academic stars as we should. Instead, they become lost in space with some college, no degree, and potentially a mound of student debt, which is something we are not excited about, and they don't deserve. And I don't believe that any of us would want them to be a part of that legacy. We also have a lot of success stories in moving students through what have been high risk factors. How was that done? Well, first, here's what retention rates look like over the last decade for all of our public universities. As you can see, the needle has not moved too far over that period, rising about 3 percentage points. What you can see here is that the uptick in retention success after the 2007 investment in higher education made by the legislature with $755 million in public university support or investment. And not coincidentally, this is the exact amount that the universities are asking this body to support our students with today. There are special programs on all of our campuses that receive external funding or small efforts externally with pilot-sized groups that are being served. One example that shows this intensive and intrusive support service that makes all the difference in the world to students with high risk factors are such as the TRIO program at Western Oregon University. This program receives 60% of its funding from the feds, and Western covers roughly 40% through campus funding and in-kind support. If we compare the success outcomes of Western's TRIO students to their students with a similar demographic profile who are not able to be in the program due to limited slots, here's what you see. Almost 80% of these students are retained at Western Oregon to the second year. This compares to less than 70% of students who are not in the program. By any measure, this is substantial. TRIO-type programs on campuses across Oregon, on campuses across America, make an extraordinary impact because they invest in people. With me today is Angela Kimball, who is a sophomore at Western Oregon and who is a part of the TRIO program and can demonstrate the kinds of support that she received that enables her to stay in school. Angela, could you join me?
Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning,
Co-Chair Monroe and Co-Chair Comp and the rest of the committee. I'm Angela Kimball. I'm a sophomore at Western Oregon University, and I'm also a criminal justice major from Coos Bay, Oregon. I know our trio program at Western very well because I feel the best way to explain that to you or like show how much TRIO has an impact on our students is by giving you my history. So I would not be in college at this time without the TRIO program because I had no desire to go to college whatsoever. When I was 12 years old, my mother went to prison and my dad was, you know, he was not in the position to be a parent. And my twin and I went through many, many different foster homes, but I was a lucky one and I landed in a very good home. But there was nobody in my life who had had any education past high school, and most people had dropped out during high school. So I enlisted into the National Guard at the age of 17 because it was a childhood dream and I saw no other real strong options for myself. But a couple weeks before my graduation date, I actually received a medical discharge due to a lung condition from exposure to bad home environments. So I was at a bypass and I wasn't sure what I was doing with my life. Wow. So I had been recently reintroduced to my biological parents at that time, and they encouraged me to go to a SOAR date at the university, which is like a you come and visit the college and they try to convince you to go there. And I went there and I actually met our director Marshall and many of the advisors at that SOAR date, and I was forced to fill out their paperwork. They were very, very awesome, and they kept encouraging me to try out for their program called Summer Bridge, which I eventually, you know, later that summer, I decided to go to because I was selected. I was one of 40 students selected to go to that. And it's a program that's for first-generation college students. They get you in on campus a week before anybody else arrives. And you just get this amazing opportunity to learn about your college and about just the entire college experience that I had no idea. College was, you know, an otherworldly thing. I didn't know anything about it. So I met 40 amazing friends, and I made these connections with professors at campus and, you know, other students and staff members like my advisors today that I never would have had without the TRIO program. In the TRIO program, I've gained a lot of self-confidence, I believe, because I eventually went back as a peer advisor for that Summer Bridge program. And they're amazing. Marshall got me in touch with another scholarship because I have an EFC of zero. So, you know, I'm one of those students that don't have any funding coming from any family members or anything. So every connection helps and everything like that. And TRIO has definitely changed my life. And I made an agreement with my parents that I'd go to college for the first term and I would try it out. And I wasn't planning on staying after the first term because when I went into college, I was already dead set against it because I was done with high school. I was done with school. I wanted to go into the workforce. But my advisors and my advisor, they were amazing. They convinced me to go through, and now I'm here a sophomore, and I am considering graduate school, which wasn't, and I mean, I wasn't even considering being an undergrad, so that's a big deal for me. But I really want to thank you guys for your time and for funding things like the Pell Grant and stuff like that, because I wouldn't be in school without that today.
Madam Co-Chair.
Thank you. I'm wondering, how's your twin? Did she go? Is she following in your footsteps?
Actually, he's my twin brother, and he enlisted into the Army shortly after I did when he turned 18. And he... is stationed in Washington, D.C. right now with the Honor Guard. So
he's on a good path, too.
He's on a good path. It took him a bit, but we knocked some sense into him.
Thank you.
Additional questions for Angela? Senator Robles.
Thank you. I would say it's great to see you being as successful and recognizing it's really all you. Trio's great, and it's a wonderful thing, but it takes people to take advantage of it, too. And I hope that your time in Coos Bay helped a little bit. I know it was a tough ride, so thanks.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And thank you for coming in this morning.
Of course.
Okay. Thank you for having me. Romano, who's next?
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I hope you're not skipping class.
Yeah.
I had the morning off.
Oh, okay.
You know, I think she demonstrates what can happen when, as you said, good decisions are owned and made, but then there's support people, support services to help pursue that. To give you an example, just one example, when I walked into Eastern Oregon University just over a year ago, I was surprised by the environment that I saw. Most of our units in student services were literally one person. In one case, I was surprised to find that we had no career center. How do you operate a university without a career center? Mm-hmm. We just hired our new director of career services last month, who started this last week from Lynn Benton Community College after a national search. It's about people at the end of the day. And if there's one message to be had, all of us have stories. You know, if it were not Trio, and I have to tell you, a gardener at the University of Oregon, who, tears in my eyes, too much of a difficult of an environment. I saw my first snow. The fact of the matter was I was ready to head back to San Diego, but I didn't. And then I had people to turn to. And what this $755 million investment means for all of you is that there will be people on the other side of the equation in student services, not just in the faculty, not just giving the lecture, because the lecture is a small piece of the academic experience, as all of us remember. But at the end of the day, when you think long and hard about those lasting memories and who made those biggest marks in your life, sure, it was a faculty member, but it was also somebody in student support services who was teaching you about heartache, loss, balance, time management, have faith in yourself, make those good decisions. They don't happen accidentally. We have learned from this story and others like it because Eastern Oregon is going after TRIO support services. We can't just look to the state for our solutions. We understand that. We have to look externally. And we are doing that with a level of vigor and aggressiveness that is new to our community. Is changing some perceptions rather quickly. Another student story that I want you to hear from Portland State University, Laura Aguilon, who will share her perspective from Portland State and the choices and implications that those choices have made. So, Laura.
Welcome. Why don't you go ahead and identify yourself and proceed.
Awesome. Thank you, Chairman Monroe and Representative Comp and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laura Uggen. Senator Roblin, I want to wish you a very happy birthday. It's very exciting. Thank you for allowing me to come and speak to you today on the student perspective and allow you a little bit more insight into what it's like to be a student in the current education system. So I personally am not a traditional student. I'm a junior transfer from Portland State. I went to Mount Hood. I spent a couple more years. Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you remember me, but I actually served on the Board of Education when I was student body president. So I have lived in Oregon my whole life, and I love this state, and I'm very excited to be able to speak on behalf of students who normally don't get to speak out for themselves. So in being a student and an active student leader in my community, I also get to be a fabulous parent to a beautiful three-year-old little girl, and she is the light of my world and is one of my driving forces. But I wouldn't be able to be here today if it wasn't for a generous scholarship support. And I've worked very hard to earn those. And I'm really proud that I get to be here and be in school because of that. But it still requires me to work additional hours to cover the costs of fees and other things that occur while I'm in school. So I am, you know, a very rare case, and unfortunately I'm not the norm when it comes to student parents or non-traditional students. Most students, including myself, were really living financially disbursement to disbursement, and that's very much a struggle. It's a very careful balancing act when it comes to managing my own education, being a parent, and, you know, some days finding the gumption to even go to class and, you know, stay up late and read all the textbooks that I have piled up next to me. But it's so important to be reminded how valuable and important it is to keep students like myself and other non-traditional students in the classroom, because it's for the community, and it's not only for you know, an individual. Let's see. So I know that a lot of people in my generation have been on the receiving end of this sentiment that back in my day, I was able to work and pay for school on my own, and maybe you're just not working hard enough to get where you want to go. And that's really negative, and I hope none of you believe in that statement, because I want to, like, firmly reassure you that that is not the truth, and that's not the reality of today. This slide kind of briefly demonstrates the difference in 1974, that 15 weeks of working at a minimum wage job would be able to afford you a year of college. And then now in 2014, we're up to 43 weeks. And that's vastly different. And that adds additional strain and barriers to students, including myself and other non-traditional students. And frankly, I don't know how much more coffee I can put in my system to keep up this. So the next slide, you've probably seen plenty of times, is the difference in the appropriations of the general state fund towards education back in 87 to 89, the biennium allocated 15% of the funds, and currently we are less than 5%. And so something a little humorous is that instead of public universities, they should be called student universities, since we are one of the largest shareholders funding these at the time. This next slide shows the percentage of general state funds that went towards public higher education in Oregon versus what we are looking at today. The green is our state investment, and the purple is our student investment. So the fallout of support in first Oregon students comes with consequences that we've covered a little bit throughout the day. And those consequences equate to the amount of students that were able to graduate. And students want to have the resources to fully commit themselves to their education. But at this point, students are having to make the decision between housing and food, over covering the cost of their education, which, you know, we incurred more debt and we're staying in school longer. And so this is a decision that no one should have to make in order to earn their education. So we ask you to consider the decisions that will positively impact Oregon students, because we're the leaders of today and tomorrow, and we're worth the investment. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Morning, Co-Chair Monroe. Co-Chair Comp, committee members, my name is Craig Morris. I'm the Vice President of Finance and Administration at Southern Oregon University. It's a pleasure to be with you this morning. On the slide that's up right now, we thought we would share with you how we got to that infamous $755 million number. So if you look at the first column, that shows the 2007-09 funding level, 72,000 students at $693 million, and that represents the E&G portion of the higher education budget. In the current biennium, with 87,000 students, we're at $521 million, or $561 million with the tuition backfill. And we're asking for $755, which is the 2007-09 funding level, plus the roll-up of the tuition buy-down backfill of $60-something million. So how do we spend that money? Where does it go? And this slide represents an all-fund snapshot of the Oregon University system or the seven public universities' budgets. By all funds, I mean that includes our E&G or operating budget, the auxiliary budget, and all of the restricted funds that go along with our complex financing structures. So even under that microscope, 61% goes to compensation and benefits, 21% goes to services and supplies, and services and supplies are things as basic as utilities, facilities costs, technology, state assessments, shared services costs, et cetera. And then the other one I'll point out to you is debt service. That's a fixed cost, of course, and it ties primarily to our auxiliaries. 11 F bonds have been sold to fund residence halls and student health and wellness centers and student unions, et cetera. And so that is debt service that the institutions pay out of their operating budgets as opposed to state-backed debt service. So when we look at our actual E&G or operating budget, we have some costs that and revenues that we don't have a lot of control over. So the first one being tuition rates. As you know, over the years, we've faced situations where the universities have been capped at tuition rates, or we've had buy downs, right now we're faced with going forward to the Higher Education Coordinating Commission for any increases greater than 5%. For enrollment, we're seeing flattening enrollment across the state. All seven universities are looking at that. And, of course, you know, we're the victims of our, if you will, the consumer, our student consumer, and the number of student credit hours that they buy from us each term. State appropriation, as you well can appreciate, we see it as uncertain and hasn't been stable over the last several years. We all know why. Philanthropy is restricted. Co-Chair Compe, you had made a question before about the role of foundations in our budget. Mm-hmm. So at Southern Oregon University, and I think this is true at the other universities, our foundation does not contribute to the operations of our university. We have a $28 million endowment, and that endowment is used exclusively for scholarships for our students. So it buys down the affordability for them, but it does not contribute to the operations.
Thank you.
Yes. And grants, those are typically research grants, and they are restricted for the research that they have been granted for, of course. And then expenditures. So just on our regular operating budget, 80% goes to salaries and benefits. And collective bargaining agreements drive compensation increases, as you can appreciate. What DAS does with the SEIU for classified employees becomes the foundation for what our bargaining outcomes are for higher education classified employees as we bargain with SEIU, that then become the foundation for our faculty union negotiations, and then become the what's left over goes to our non-represented employees. So little control is left in our hands in terms of compensation, and even less so when it comes to PERS and PEB increases, and I know you appreciate that problem. And then, of course, there's the general inflation that we continue to deal with. At my institution, we have not increased S&S funding for our institution in 7 years in spite of inflation, so we keep absorbing inflationary growth in our S&S budgets. The next two slides demonstrate the funding per degree for the universities, and this one shows the three big institutions, U of O, OSU, and Portland State, and with their peers, they are the third lowest in funding per degree at just a hair under $50,000 per degree. Number two, Alabama, is double that per degree. And the next slide shows the TRUES. They are the seventh lowest funding per degree, and you can see the comparisons nationally. So while we're grateful for the proposed co-chair's budget, we feel that it's a budget that is status quo, that will not allow us to grow the outcomes that we want to grow. Last spring,
The Higher Education Coordinating Commission asked all seven universities to prepare a fairly comprehensive budget request. And a large part of that budget request was an in-depth analysis of what we would do if we got more money. And all seven universities, not in discussion with each other, came back with basically the same response. The universities see that in order for 40-40-20 to be successful, we have to start engaging a whole different or additional, if you will, population of students in the state. And these are students that I'm going to define as at-risk students, low-income, first-generation minority students. So not only do we have to reach out to them and recruit them, but once we've recruited them and we've given them the sense that they actually can belong in higher education, that it's a place that they can be successful in and they can get to, so once we get them, we have to give them the additional help that they're going to need to be able to not just persist to degree, but persist to a timely degree. And we won't be able to do that without the additional funding that we're asking for. And the last several slides that I'm just going to just bounce through are different concepts from each one of the seven universities that come from or are highlights from those comprehensive reports, that this is the kind of stuff that will be done by our universities should we get additional funding beyond the co-chair's budget. So you can see at Eastern, affordability and tuition mitigation for underserved populations, bilingual programs, increase in graduation rates, dual credit courses, Oregon Tech improved retention and degrees for students of color, early intervention alert and lower student financial aid barriers. Oregon State, there's a September Scholars Program, which is a summer bridge program, unrepresented student retention, financial aid navigations for admissions, STEM program enhancements. Portland State graduating 500 more students, and another bridge program for the summer for students, additional advising staff, affordability programs. Southern, our Pirates to Raiders program, which is a partnership with K through 12 in our Jackson County, and expanding financial aid staff to help with students and putting more resources into our Raider Academy. U of O, expand the pathway to Oregon, assistance grant for graduation. Western Oregon, remission scholarships, investment in STEM, academic support services. You get the point. It's all about servicing those at-risk students. And I'll close with, on my campus in a couple of weeks, we're going to bring 1,000 12-year-olds to our campus, all from Jackson County Schools. Now, we don't think that those 1,000 students are going to become SOU students, but what we hope that they will gain from this experience is that they'll see the excitement and the future and the possibility of higher education as a very viable alternative for them. So if we all seven of our institutions continue to do that kind of work, with the extra money that we're asking for, we'll have much more opportunity of being successful and moving towards 40-40-20.
Thank you, Mr. Morris. Mm-hmm. We appreciate you coming. Mr. Siebert, before we adjourn.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to announce your committee administrator, Doug Wilson, asked that I make sure folks know that public testimony on public universities will be Tuesday, April 14th.
Madam Co-Chair, anything for the good?
No, let's just, keep rocking and rolling.
Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you very much. Thank everybody, and we're adjourned.
Happy birthday, Arnie.
Everybody, and we're adjourned.
Happy birthday, Arnie.